As soon as the American woman and her cameraman had left the cottage, Moses Garmer began to rise from the table. "It is done," he said. "Now we can leave." "Not yet, my uncle," Rally Tabaka stopped him. "There is something else that we must do first." "It is dangerous to delay," Moses insisted. "We have been in this place too long. The police have informers everywhere." "Yes, my uncle. The police informers are everywhere." Rally put a peculiar emphasis on his agreement. "But before you go on to the place where the police cannot touch you, we must talk." Rally came to stand at the front of the table facing his uncle. "This was planned with great care. This afternoon, the white monster Favut was assassinated in the racist parliament." Moses started. "You did not tell me this," he protested, but Rally went on quietly. "The plan was that in the confusion after Favut's assassination, you would emerge to lead a spontaneous rising of our people." "Why was I not told of this?" Moses asked fiercely. "Patience, my uncle. Hear me out. The men who planned this are from a cold, bleak land in the north. They do not understand the African soul. They do not understand that our people will not rise until their mood is ready, until their rage is ripe. That time is not yet. It will take many more years of patient work to bring their rage to full fruit. Only then can we gather the harvest. The white police are still too strong. They could crush us by raising their little finger, and the world would stand by and watch us die as they watched the rebellion in Hungary die." "I do not understand," Moses said. "Why have you gone this far if you did not intend to travel to the end of the road?" "The revolution needs martyrs as well as leaders. The mood and temper of the world must be roused, for without them we can never succeed. Martyrs and leaders, my uncle." "I am the chosen leader of our people," Moses Garmer said simply. "No, my uncle," Rally shook his head. "You have proved unworthy. You have sold out your people. In exchange for your life, you delivered the revolution into the hands of the enemy. You gave Nelson Mandela and the heroes of Rivonia to the foe. Once I believed you were a god, but now I know that you are a traitor." Moses Garmer stared at him silently. "I am glad you do not deny this, my uncle. Your guilt is proven beyond any doubt. By your action, you have forfeited any claim to the leadership. Nelson Mandela alone has the greatness for that role. However, my uncle, the revolution needs martyrs." From the pocket of his jacket, Rally Tabaka took something wrapped in a clean white cloth. He laid it on the table. Slowly he opened the bundle, taking care not to touch what it contained. They both stared at the revolver. "This pistol is police issue. Only hours ago it was stolen from a local police arsenal. The serial number is still on the police register. It is loaded with police issue ammunition." Rally folded the cloth around the grip of the pistol. "It still has the fingerprints of the police officers upon it," he said. Carrying the pistol, he went round the table to stand behind Moses Garmer's chair and placed the muzzle of the pistol at the back of his neck. From outside the cottage, they heard the singing again. "God save Africa," Rally repeated the words. "You are fortunate, my uncle. You have a chance to redeem yourself. You are going to a place where nobody can ever touch you again, and your name will live forever, pure and unsullied. The great martyr of Africa who died for his people." Moses Garmer did not move or speak, and Rally went on softly. "The people have been told you are here. They are gathered outside in their hundreds. They will bear witness to your greatness. Your name will live forever." Then, above the singing, they heard the police sirens coming closer, wailing and sobbing. "The brutal fascist police have also been told that you are here," Rally said softly. Sound of the sirens built up, and then there were the roar of engines, the squeal of brakes, the slamming of Land Rover doors, the shouted commands, the pounding footsteps, and the crash of the front door being smashed in with sledgehammers. as Brigadier Lothar de Larrey led his men in through the front door of the cottage. Rally Tabaka said softly, "Go in peace, my uncle." And he shot Moses Gama in the back of the head. The heavy bullet threw Moses forward. His shattered head slammed face down upon the table. The contents of his skull and chips of white bone splattered against the wall and over the kitchen floor. Raleigh dropped the police pistol onto the table and slipped out into the dark yard. He joined the watching throng in the street outside, mingling with them, waiting with them until the covered body was carried out of the front door of the cottage on a stretcher. Then he shouted in a strong, clear voice, "The police have murdered our leader! They have killed Moses Gama!" As the cry was taken up by 100 other voices, and the women began the haunting ululation of mourning, Raleigh Tabaka turned and walked away into the darkness. A servant opened the front door of Weltevreden to Manfred de Larrey. "The master is expecting you," he said respectfully. "Please come with me." He led Manfred to the gunroom and closed the double mahogany doors behind him. Manfred stood on the threshold. There was a log fire burning in the hearth of the stone fireplace, and Shaza Courtney stood before it. He was wearing a dinner jacket and black tie, and a new black silk patch over his eye. He was tall and debonair, with silver wings of hair at his temples, but his expression was merciless. Santon Courtney sat at the desk below the gun racks. She also wore evening dress, a brocaded Chinese silk in her favourite shade of yellow, with a necklace of magnificent yellow diamonds from the Hani mine. Her arms and shoulders were bare, and in the muted light her skin seemed flawless and smooth as a young girl's. "White sword," Shaza greeted him softly. "Yeah," Manfred nodded. "But that was long ago, in another war." "You killed an innocent man, a noble old man. The bullet was intended for another, for a traitor, an Afrikaner who had delivered his people to the British yoke." "You were a terrorist then, as Gama and Mandela are terrorists now. Why should your punishment be any different from theirs?" "Our cause was just, and God was on our side," Manfred replied. "How many innocents have died for what other men call just causes? How many atrocities have been committed in God's name?" "You cannot provoke me," Manfred shook his head. "What I attempted was right and proper." "We shall see whether or not the courts of this land agree with you," Shaza said, and looked across the room at Santon. "Please ring the number on the pad in front of you, Mother. Ask for Colonel Botmer of CID. I have already asked him to be available to come here." Santon made no move, and her expression as she studied Manfred de Larrey was tragic. "Please do it, Mother," Shaza insisted. "No," Manfred intervened. "She cannot do it, and nor can you." "Why do you believe that?" "Tell him, Mother," said Manfred. Shaza frowned quickly and angrily, but Santon held up her hand to stop him speaking. "It is true," she whispered. "Manfred is as much my son as you are, Shaza. I gave birth to him in the desert. Although his father took him still wet and blind from my childbed, although I did not see him again for almost 13 years, he is still my son." In the silence, one of the logs in the fireplace fell in a soft shower of ash, and it sounded like an avalanche. "Your grandfather has been dead for 20 years and more, Shaza. Do you want to break my heart by sending your brother to the gallows?" "My duty, my honor," Shaza faltered. "Manfred was as merciful once. He had it in his power to destroy your political career before it began. At my request, and in the knowledge that you were brothers, he spared you." Santon was speaking softly but remorselessly. "Can you do less?" But he is only your bastard, Shaza blurted. You are my bastard also, Shaza. Your father was killed on our wedding day before the ceremony. That was the fact that Manfred could have used to destroy you. He had you in his power, as he is now in your power. What will you do, Shaza? Shaza turned away from her and stood with his head bowed, staring into the fireplace. When he spoke at last, his voice was racked with pain. The friendship, the brotherhood even, all of it is an illusion, he said. It is you, mother, whom I must honor. No one replied to him, and he turned back to Manfred. You will inform the caucus of the National Party that you are not available for the premiership, and you will retire from public life, he said quietly, and saw Manfred flinch and the ruination of his dreams in the agony of his expression. That is the only punishment I can inflict upon you, but perhaps it is more painful and lingering than the gallows. Do you accept it? You are destroying yourself at the same time, Manfred told him. Without me, the presidency is beyond your grasp. That is my punishment, Shaza agreed, and I accept it. Do you accept yours? I accept, said Manfred de la Rey. He turned to the double mahogany doors, flung them open, and strode from the room. Shaza stared after him. Only when they heard his car pull away down the long driveway did he turn back to Santon. She was weeping, as she had wept on the day that he brought her the news of Blaine Malcolmès' death. My son, she whispered. My sons. And he went to comfort her. A week after the death of Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, the caucus of the National Party elected Balthazar Johannes Forster to the Premiership of South Africa. He owed his elevation to the awe-inspiring reputation that he had built for himself while he was Minister of Justice. He was a strong man in the mould of his predecessor, and in his acceptance speech he stated boldly, "My role is to walk fearlessly along the road already pointed out by Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd." 3 days after his election, he sent for Shaza Courtney. "I want personally to thank you for your hard work and loyalty over the years, but now I think it is time for you to take a well-earned rest. I would like you to go as the South African ambassador to the Court of St. James in London. I know that with you there, South Africa House will be in good hands." It was the classic dismissal. But Shaza knew that the golden rule for politicians is never to refuse office. "Thank you, Prime Minister," he replied. 30,000 mourners attended the funeral of Moses Gama in Drake's Farm Township. Rally Tabaka organized the funeral and was the captain of the honor guard of Amkonte Wesizwe that stood at the graveside and gave the ANC salute as the coffin was lowered into the earth. Vicky Dinizulu Gama, dressed in her flowing kaftan of yellow and green and black, defied her banning order to make a speech to the mourners. Fierce and strikingly beautiful, she told them, "We must devise a death for the collaborators and sellouts. That is so grotesquely horrible that not one of our people will ever dare to turn traitor upon us." The sorrow of the multitudes was so terrible that when a young woman amongst them was pointed out as a police informer, they stripped her naked and whipped and beat her until she fell unconscious. Then they doused her with petrol and set her alight and kicked her while she burned. Afterwards, the children urinated on her charred corpse. The police dispersed the mourners with tear gas and baton charges. Kitty Godolphin filmed it all, and when the footage was cut with that of Moses Gama and the graphic footage from the scene of his brutal slaying by the police, it was amongst the most gripping and horrifying ever shown on American television. When Kitty Godolphin was promoted to head of NABS News, she became the highest-paid female editor in American television. Before taking up his post as ambassador in London, Shaza went on a 4-week safari in the Zambezi Valley with his eldest son. The Courtney Safaris hunting concession covered 500 square miles of wonderful game-rich wilderness, and Mutatu led Shaza to lion and buffalo and a magnificent old bull elephant. The Rhodesian Bush War was becoming deadly earnest. Sean had been awarded the Silver Cross of Rhodesia for gallantry, and around the campfire he described how he had won it. "Oh, Mutatu and I were following a big bull jumbo when we cut the spoor of 12 Zanu gooks. We dropped the jumbo and tracked the turs. It was pissing with rain and the cloud was on the treetops, so the fire force couldn't get in to back us up. The turs were getting close to the Zambezi, so we pushed up on them. The first warning we had that they had set an ambush for us was when we saw the fairy lights in the grass just ahead of us. Mutatu was leading, and he took the first burst in the belly. That made me fairly bitter, and I went after the gooks with the old .577. It was 5 miles to the river, and they ran like the clappers of hell, but I polished off the last two in the water before they could reach the Zambian side. When I turned round, there was Mutatu standing right behind me. The little bugger had backed me up for 5 miles with his tripes hanging out of the hole in his guts." Across the campfire, the little Ndorobo's face had brightened as he heard his name mentioned, and Sean told him in Swahili, "Show the Bwana Makuba your new belly button." Obligingly, Mutatu hoisted his tattered shirt tails and displayed for Shaza the fearsome scars the AK-47 bullets had left on his stomach. "You're a stupid little bugger," Sean told him severely, "running around with a hole in your guts, instead of lying down and dying like you should have." "You are bloody stupid, Mutatu." Mutatu's whole body wriggled with pleasure. "Bloody stupid bugger," he agreed proudly. He knew that this was the highest accolade to which he could possibly aspire, uttered as it was by the godhead of his entire firmament.